Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Health Tech Pitching Podcast, analysing the best health tech stories of the week every single week. Today, I'm joined by Somix's very own Jess Farmery and, of course, producer Adama, and obviously we're excited to run through some really cool stories this week, everything from neurotech through to medtech bias and the EU AI Act. But before we do, Jess, Adama, hi, how are you both?
Hi, you. Good to be here. It's been a busy week, as always, but I am very excited by the stories we've got in Pigeon this week. It's not often that we get to do a neurotech-focused episode, so it's going to be a real treat.
Fantastic. Well, without further ado, I suggest we get going. So on to our first story. On to our first story, which comes to us from Business Insider. This biotech startup wants to prevent unhappiness. Here's the pitch deck Matter Neuroscience used to raise $26 million. So, Matter Neuroscience is a very exciting company that set out to find a biomarker for happiness, something they've had clearly mixed success directly for doing, but as their really quite entertaining pitch deck shows, they've found an indirect way to measure happiness and the various aspects of the brain that guide it. So, Jess, you've had a look at this one. Can you tell us some more about Matter and what they're doing?
Yeah, Matter have emerged from stealth with a cool $26 million. And they are partnering with scientists from various labs. And they have done a study to try and stimulate positive emotions in the participants and to map out which part of the brain activates with these emotions. And they're using this information to try and provide personalized happiness recommendations to participants through their app. And they're going to release this app to consumers for public use. And they're aiming to help people capture and reflect on positive moments and understand the molecular basis for these experiences and use that understanding to shape their future happiness. And the founder thinks that reflecting on positive memories is the best way to trigger positive emotions reliably. I think maybe from anecdotal experience, looking back, reminiscing on happy times does tend to give you a bit of a that dose of some of that serotonin. So I can see where there might be some truth to this. But yeah, I think saying that you're going to sell happiness to your users is probably a great approach to investors. So I can see why they were successful in raising such a big chunk of cash for this one.
Yeah, it's really interesting, isn't it? And this link, the link between the outline between happiness and pretty much everything from how, you know, your own longevity to overconsumption, abuse, aggression, addiction, criminality, and war. Which I think we can all agree, if we can tackle all of those just by getting people, making people happier, that would be fantastic. I'm really enjoying this one, not least because the deck is fantastic. Really, not just really stylish, really interesting, really outstanding. It's got some wonderful graphics in that show the link between happiness and unhappiness, posing this theory that the difference between happiness and unhappiness is learning and compensation, but it is reversible. So everything you learn, everything you understand, everything you know will trigger basically you being happier or you being unhappier. I guess there's a lot of bold claims in the deck.
Packed full of bold claims. Yeah, some of my favourite bold claims here is that feeling happy adds 10 to 15 healthy years to your life, whereas unhappiness is the underlying cause for all mental and social diseases. So yeah, definitely bold.
I'm very interested to see some of the metrics behind this and some of the data. And while, you know, they are hidden at the bottom of the deck in references, I'm quite keen to kind of go and have a look and see whether there's charts as to how happy you have to be in order to be 10 to 15 years longer on the planet than, you know, unhappy. At what point is the threshold? Can I be middlingly pessimistic and just have an extra 7 years or something like that?
I'll take that.
But who knows?
I would really, even though we are on a podcast and people can't see the deck, I would very much recommend that people dive into that article and look at the deck. I think it's just, beautifully designed, really good example of kind of how to tell your story through a deck in a kind of easy to digest, engaging way. But one slide they've got, they define something called the Matter Protocol, and they call it an algorithm that learns from your memory information, provides you with personal recommendations to improve your long-term happiness in real time, both emotionally and molecularly. So yeah, it's a very interesting sounding algorithm. It'd be great to get some more information on exactly how it learns from your memory information. I'm imagining some kind of mind reading algorithm here, but I'm sure that it just takes data that you have to then input based on your memories and churns out some smart recommendations from that.
Well, I mean, I think you're absolutely right on the deck. And I think one thing that really stands out from this is just how clearly they've got their message nailed down, even though it's they're having to go, I guess, the roundabout way to getting to the point that they want to. They're doing it very concisely and clearly. Each slide is just a really key message that sets out the problem, sets out the challenge, sets out how they've done what they've done. I really love this idea that happiness is defined by 6 neurotransmitters on a molecular level. So if you are interested in the science behind happiness, or at least the science behind happiness as matter are defining it, absolutely worth checking out their deck and checking out what the company is doing as well.
Yeah, I mean, I can't help but state the obvious, which is that it might be a little bit more complicated than simply an algorithm to make 8 billion people on the planet happy. It might be some social, economic and political organisation that needs to go on first, but it's definitely a laudable ambition they've got to make everybody happy on the planet.
So the final standout piece of information we've not really touched upon yet is that this deck raised Matter $26 million. This, let's be fair, is one of the bigger raises we've typically seen for some of the neuroscience applications out there. Is the secret to happiness worth $26 million? What do we think?
Surely it's priceless. Don't think you can really put that on an investor deck, though, when you're asking how much money you want to raise, just putting, like, infinite sum probably is not going to go down very well.
They should definitely have put that on the final slide of the ask to investors, is what's your actual ask? Whatever you've got, the happiness is priceless.
Well, they say that money can't buy happiness, but Matter think that you can indeed buy happiness with $26 million.
I think there's nothing left to say to that other than on to our next story. Another no less impressive raise. TechEU has the news that health tech company Sumer Medical has announced a new funding of 5 million euros, bringing its total funding to 7.5 million euros. Sumer has a transcranial direct stimulation device, which it uses to stimulate the brain and alleviate depression symptoms. So very much on the theme that we're pursuing this week of neurotech devices making you feel happier, or at least dealing with your depression. I mean, what does this news mean for us, Jess?
So anyone who's had their eyes glued to the health tech news as I do might remember that there was a company called Samphire Neuroscience who raised money recently for a similar kind of technology, this transcranial direct current stimulation. And they used it to try and manage menstrual chronic pain and mood symptoms by targeting the prefrontal and motor cortex. So this is another example of this same technology, but using to treat a different condition. So, yeah, it kind of begs the question, what other pain conditions or conditions could this sort of technology be used for?
So this feels like a really interesting story, not least because it comes on the back of a sort of fairly similar sounding story from a couple of weeks ago, where Flow Neuroscience, I believe using a very similar kind of technology, transcranial direct stimulation, had announced a partnership with the NHS to help trial its technology in treating symptoms of depression and burnout among clinicians. From what we've been able to read about this technology so far, it sounds like it's going to take a fairly similar approach with the brain stimulation and the use of pulses through this technology, indeed to treat similar conditions around depression as well. So I think for me, what's going to be interesting not only is, you know, are these technologies going to grow in parallel, or are they going to find different use cases? Are we going to see more treatment for sort of mental health conditions such as this, alongside, Jess, as what you said, some of the pain challenges? And how far can we take transcranial direct stimulation in terms of how we treat, I guess, not just the symptoms of conditions, but also the conditions themselves? So that's going to be an interesting one to follow.
Yeah, it says in this article that there are already 20,000 patients worldwide who are benefiting from these technologies, and it can help patients feel symptom relief within a few weeks, assisting them in overcoming work impairment and returning to regular routines. So for the millions of people who do suffer with depression around the world, this is probably some really positive news, and yeah, probably could offer hope to a lot of people who find their lives really disrupted by conditions like depression.
I think a trend that's going to be interesting to follow off the back of this is how we can treat conditions like depression, mental health conditions, without the use of drugs, which obviously have a considerable range of side effects. Apparently, according to this article, Sumo was actually the first trans direct cranial stimulation device manufacturer to receive the medical device regulation certification. So, you know, hopefully this is the first of many similar or at least, complementary treatments for doing this, which, as it's a... it's definitely a challenge for us to address. Okay, so our third story comes to us from The Guardian, and it's a big one. This is the story that a report initially commissioned by Sajid Javid when he was health secretary has finally reported, and it's looking at bias within medtech tools and devices. So long-term medtech bias nerds will remember a couple of years ago when there was quite a lot of controversy about the use of pulse oximeters and optical medical devices in detecting blood pressure in black and brown skin, and how potentially inaccurate it was. How potentially inaccurate tools that were designed to read blood pressure optically were. No harm, it must be said, has ever been found for these tools in the NHS, but absolutely, there were some cases within the US where harm was proved. And now the report that came, that was commissioned as a result, has reported and found that minority ethnic people, women and people from deprived communities are at risk of poorer healthcare because of biases within medical tools and devices. So the Equity in Medical Devices independent review has raised concerns, says The Guardian, over devices that use artificial intelligence as well as those that measure oxygen level. The team behind the review said urgent action was needed. So there's definitely a lot to debrief in this. The review is the result of a lot of stakeholder feedback from professional individuals, professional organisations and people with lived experience as well, with almost 10% of responses to the original survey coming from people with lived experience too. So there's clearly urgent action that needs to be taken. A lot of the recommendations I've had a look through the report are very interesting. Some refer specifically to optical devices like pulse oximeters. And while the recommendations aren't to completely change how we're using the tools or to stop using the tools, there are recommendations to put in extra safeguards. Equally, with this, the scope of the report taking in AI as well, there's also recommendations for how we reduce bias. My most interesting takeaway is how very clearly a lot of the report examines the fact that, you know, bias is unintentional, which I think most of us would have expected. I don't think there is a lot of intentional bias going on in healthcare, but I think addressing some of that unintentional bias is obviously key and should be a priority going forward. Jess, you've had a look at the article. What are your views?
Yeah, I mean, there's a part in the article which says that there's concern over AI-based devices and technology and like the use of AI in healthcare because of the data sets that are used to train AI are often quite homogenous data sets that don't have very much diversity in them, just because of the way that historically data has been collected and the kind of patient populations that these data sets come from. And that just kind of made me think of a pigeon episode that we recorded probably around this time last year, where we talked about quite an interesting project that's going on in Birmingham hospitals with a company called Curate, who are actually building specific artificial intelligence models using really diverse data sets from Birmingham's populations to try and ensure that lung disease treatment can be improved in that hospital, and building models that properly reflect the diversity of the population. So I think it's just worth noting that there are several different projects going on across the country that are working really hard to make sure that future AI models and AI tools don't have the same kind of bias baked into them that some of the previous ones did.
The Create example is such a good one, isn't it? Because it's really, really doing something to address those data sets and address sort of how, I guess, treatments are developed and you know, therapies are developed in the future as well. I mean, I guess we're probably quite privileged to sort of you know, work with a lot of companies that are aiming to address a lot of these challenges, and a lot of the recommendations within the report sort of address that every stage of the development and design of med tech devices, health tech, digital health, and even into other drugs and therapies as well, looking at clinical trials, looking at user-centered design. One piece that caught my interest is whether we are doing enough to, whether the current safeguards to ensure that treatments that technologies are designed with a diverse range of patients in mind are enough. Are they just checkboxes? And I'm thinking of things like the requirement to demonstrate how your technology has been designed with to reflect user needs. Are these just sort of tick boxes? Are they not, I guess, fixed enough? Are they not firm or strict enough in terms of whether a technology can be procured for use in healthcare at the moment? Do we need to do more there?
Yeah, I mean, I guess the only way to tell whether a technology is will guarantee equal outcomes for all patients it's used with is to kind of monitor data really carefully over an extended period of time, something which is not always possible to do or not always popular amongst companies or healthcare organisations that just want to get these technologies into use and benefiting patients as quickly as possible. So there is a bit of a clash between the fact that you need large amounts of data to truly find out whether there is bias built into your system. But again, gathering that data requires the technology to be used in a large number of patients over a large number of time, over a long period of time. So is it ethical to do that without having collected the data already?
Well, that's a really interesting question. Should we be doing it until we've made these steps? Is there the chance of delaying some of these treatments' journey to patients or the speed at which they can get to the bedside if we have to collect as wide a spread and as much data as possible, possibly to reflect some of these challenges? It's I don't think something we can answer on this podcast.
I'm sure there are teams of people working on establishing the best middle ground.
Final consideration from me on this one. This has been published in March 2024. It's been running for 2 years, based off something in the region of 50 to 100 responses of a survey. It's obviously a lot of great work that's gone into it. Is it telling us anything new?
I mean, I feel like I've heard this conversation about bias in medical devices many times, and around the time of the pandemic, again, this conversation was going on, and it was very clear that these pulse oximeters especially were delivering suboptimal results for people that were not Caucasian. I guess the bigger question is, what will change based off of this report? How will these learnings get put into action? How are they going to translate into action? I'm not sure of any concrete recommendations that have come out of this or sort of like new official guidelines that have come in.
So interestingly, government has accepted all of the recommendations made within the report very quickly. I guess they're all very sensible recommendations, and I think probably in a lot of ways they're all being implemented in their own way across a range of across healthcare and the NHS, or at least I would hope so. And in fact, as we pointed to the Curate example and many others, we're probably seeing, you know, many companies and many individual organisations applying them as we speak. So on that note, let's go to our fourth and final story. So our final story is from Sifted, and it's everything you need to know to prepare for the EU's AI Act. This is the story that the AI Act, a piece of legislation put together by various organisations within the EU, has essentially passed its final hurdle and will become law in the next few months. There's a lot of requirements and a lot of conversation about, you know, whether, you know, what the value of the legislation is and what the impact's going to be. But I guess the most interesting thing about it is essentially the first piece of explicitly AI legislation published anywhere in the world. And depending on who you listen to, the EU is very proud of this piece of legislation and very keen to shout about having been the first to present such a thing. On the flip side, there's a lot of people who say that this is putting the cart before the horse a little bit. So I guess, Jess, you've read the article?
Yeah, so the article summarises the fact that they've decided to categorise by risks. So you have to define whether your AI system is high risk category, low risk or minimal risk. Some of the examples of kind of high risk categories are things like critical infrastructure, employment, private and public services, law enforcement, migration management, justice administration. And if you have developed a high-risk AI system, then there's a whole host of things that you need to do before it can be marketed and deployed. So you need to be carrying out risk assessments, developing mitigation systems, drafting technical documentation, and using training data that meets certain criteria for quality. So we can assume from that that is to try and stamp out some of the bias in training data that we just discussed earlier. And then once you've met all of those requirements, then you have to get a declaration of conformity, and then you have to start the whole CE marking process. So I think the key message here is that if you are developing an AI system that's high risk, it's going to be a long, complicated and bureaucratic process to before you can go to market with that system.
It's a difficult challenge and sort of hard to get your head around, really, isn't it? Particularly given how much, I mean, if you balance the level of complexity of getting approval for health technologies, medical technologies in Europe as it is, and some of the concerns that various trade bodies and industry bodies have already raised about how difficult it is to work with regulators in Europe and how challenging it can be to get technologies to market and through regulatory approvals that already existed, whether this AI Act is going to just make that worse, and you're going to have to go through all of these challenges even before you get to your CE mark or your medical device regulation paperwork, or whether there's an opportunity to put this kind of review into the hands of, I guess, you know, people who understand AI even better. Either way, I'd sort of expect that the people who understand AI in health better would be the ones within the European regulators. So it'll be very interesting to see how the industry reacts to this and what this starts to look like in practice when people start having to put their devices through it. Ultimately, this risk stratification thing is very similar to what a lot of regulators already do and will define what your strategy is when it comes to the medical device regulation as much as it will AI. So who knows? Maybe it'll all work out well in the end.
Yeah, but you could be fined a big chunk of cash if you fail to comply with all these regulations. So definitely watch out for that. I think it's up to 7% of your global turnover, or up to 35 million euros is the punishment for failing to comply with these new obligations. But there are going to be some regulatory sandboxes established over the next 2 years in every EU country. And in this article, there is a recommendation that any company building a high-risk AI system should go through a sandbox, which means that they can develop, train, test and validate your AI system under the supervision of a regulatory body. So that's top takeaway from our reading of this is join a sandbox, don't get fined.
Everyone loves a sandbox. Brilliant. Thanks, Jess. That's it for the Health Tech Pigeon podcast this week. Thank you so much for listening. You can find all the stories we've discussed and some of the best jobs, events and opportunities in health tech at healthtechpigeon.com. We'll be back next week. Thanks for listening.